220498, Clemmer versus Cook Hospital and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Council, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for a rebuttal. I ask that you state your name and your client's name, pronouncing each for both of us, or for both of you, before you begin your argument, and identify how you'd like us to identify yourself. With that, we're ready to go.
Good morning. My name is Sam Lochterman. I am here on behalf of appellant Cleo Clemmer. You can refer to me as Mr. Lochterman or counsel, whichever you prefer.
Thank you.
Today, this court is asked to determine whether the record, as it is currently constituted, contains substantial evidence supporting the ULJ's determination that Ms. Clemmer did not have a good reason nor a medical condition necessitating that she quit her employment as a housekeeper at Cook Hospital. After evaluating the record, this court should reverse the determination made by the ULJ and hold that Ms. Clemmer is entitled to unemployment benefits by way of a good reason to quit employment, medical necessity, or both. Alternatively, if this court does not determine that Ms. Clemmer is entitled to benefits outright, it should remand this case back to the ULJ for additional fact-finding so that Ms. Clemmer can subpoena witnesses, collect facts, and present her case, as is her right under Minnesota law. Ms. Clemmer's first argument in support of her entitlement to benefits is that Cook Hospital gave her a good reason to quit her employment by way of moving her from a schedule that placed her primarily on the afternoon shift, where she was able to work with her mask down as it was safe and appropriate to do so, to the morning shift, where she was unable to...
I mean, she was never promised particular shifts. Would that be a fair statement, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. When she began employment, she was never guaranteed she would work exclusively on one shift. And I'm glad you asked that question, Your Honor, because that is one point that I wanted to make as far as the good reason to quit analysis is concerned. The ULJ, in making its findings of fact, mentions that Ms. Clemmer was never promised she would only work on the afternoon shift. However, we believe that this sort of demonstrates a fundamental misunderstanding of the agreement that Ms. Clemmer alleges was made with Cook Hospital. Ms. Clemmer alleges not that she was promised to work solely on one shift when she initiated her employment at Cook, but rather once the PPE requirement was put in place in March of 2020, that she approached Cook again and said, I can't work for 8 hours a day with my mask on. I need to take breaks. I need to work with my mask down when I'm not around other people, when it's safe to do so. And she alleges that Cook, at least implicitly and perhaps explicitly, made an agreement affirming that she was able to continue this practice. There's substantial evidence in the record supporting such a finding.
Well, and she got the breaks, right?
I
thought her argument was, well, she got the breaks, but the problem was with all the breaks, she couldn't get her work done.
Yeah,
So that was not helpful.
Yeah, you're correct, Your Honor. And Ms. Clemmer does assert that one of the accommodations that Cook gave her was actually to allow her to continue to work on the afternoon shift where she was able to continue this
Did she
practice.
Inform her employer that, these breaks are, I'm not going to get my work done if I take all these breaks. Did she say, so we got to do something else? Is there anything in the record like about that?
There is nothing in the record, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record about the face, when they gave her the plastic mask that, it keeps falling down when I do stuff? And did she say, hey, thanks, but this isn't working either?
There is testimony in the record, Your Honor, where Ms. Clemmer informed
her. Here's the biggest problem I have, counsel. And look, I mean, I think if you have emphysema, that's really horrible. And, I certainly make my job difficult, and I'm not, cleaning things. But the problem is, and you tell me if I'm wrong, that the record indicates that Clemmer admitted her doctor never told her she should not wear a mask. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, Your Honor.
And is it also a fair statement that Clemmer admitted that her doctor would not agree to write a note stating she could not wear a mask?
That is a fair statement as well, Your Honor.
So, I mean, with that before the ULJ, it's kind of like, doesn't that sort of undercut the whole basic sympathetic argument that is, hey, she's got emphysema and we're making her wear a mask?
I think you make a good point, Your Honor, but I would point out that the ULJ made that decision that Ms. Clemmer did not have a medical condition necessitating that she not wear a mask. She did make it off of that fact that Ms. Clemmer admitted that her doctor, Eric Ellaby, had made those statements to her. However, that was really the only thing that the ULJ based it off of, just a conclusory.
Well, I agree, and yes. You know, it sounds pretty determinative to me.
Yes.
I would think if you've got emphysema and you're having trouble breathing, the last thing on earth you want to be forced to do is wear a mask, because that's going to make breathing even worse. But if that's the record, aren't we bound by that?
I would respectfully point out, Your Honor, that this court itself has decided that a doctor's note or an affirmation from a doctor is not required to meet the medical exception. And then the other thing I would submit is that...
No, but that is a slightly different case.
Yes.
But you're right.
It is distinguishable in certain aspects. I would also point out that there is also evidence in the record that while Ms. Clemmer, admitted that her doctor did not agree with her, she also tried to introduce additional medical evidence, for example, the CT scan that she had done. On her lungs that,
Well, I mean, there's no dispute she has emphysema.
Yes.
Okay, so I don't know where that gets you.
And then
isn't your better argument is that we should remand it because, maybe the doctor would have, had we actually heard the doctor and be able to question him and cross-examine him, maybe it wasn't so black and white, or maybe it's like, well, yeah, she doesn't, the mask isn't a problem, but it is a problem if X, Y, and Z. I mean, isn't that your stronger argument?
I do believe that is most likely our stronger argument.
Well, I'm glad you took the hint.
And and that is why we asked for the alternative relief of remanding for an additional fact-finding determination.
So why would it be an abuse of discretion? Why did the ULJ abuse its discretion in declining to issue a subpoena for the doctor when your client admitted that her doctor would not provide a medical exception to the face mask wearing requirement?
Yes. Our opinion is that it was an abuse of discretion because, while Ms. Clemmer did admit this, and again, it was a conclusory hearsay statement that in the record Ms. Clemmer herself does not agree with. I think the exact quote is, he told me I didn't, have to wear a mask, and I thought, are you kidding me? She goes on to describe all of the issues that she had while working while masked. So to sort of bring it back to your question is, I think it was an abuse of discretion because Dr. Ellaby would have provided relevant testimony to the to the basis for his conclusion that Ms. Clemmer did not need to wear a mask. What sort of tests were done on Ms. Clemmer? What sort of effects would have happened had she worn a mask? She should have been able to, especially since the ULJ almost primarily, if not primarily, based its decision that she didn't have a medical condition on this one piece of testimony Ms. Clemmer gave, she should have been at least afforded the opportunity to cross-examine the original source of that testimony. And while we're on the topic of subpoenas, I do believe the failure to subpoena Ms. Clemmer's immediate supervisor, Michael Tillotson, is also sort of a useful prism to look at when determining.
Why would that have been such a game changer?
Your Honor, Ms. Clemmer describes at numerous points throughout the evidentiary hearing that she had been relaying information to Michael Tillotson, her immediate supervisor. For example, at one point in her evidentiary hearing, as I mentioned earlier, she went to him at the beginning of the mask mandate and said, hey, I can't work like this. I need to work with my mask down. At other instances, she talks about describing the results of her CT scan to him or alerting him to certain medical information. And then further on in the evidentiary hearing, when Ms. Clemmer asks Ms. Leisman, who was the witness for Cook Hospital, whether Mr. Tillotson had been relaying this information to her, Ms. Leisman says, no, he hasn't. He never told me anything. So Mr. Tillotson would have been a relevant witness to subpoena because he would have been able to either corroborate or maybe deny some of the conversations that Ms. Clemmer said she had with management at Cook Hospital. I would also like to point out that this court has determined that subpoenaing such a witness is is appropriate and relevant in a different case, Sykes versus Walmart. In Sykes, there was a similar situation where the applicant for unemployment benefits had quit her employment based on the results of some coachings that she was given at Walmart. When she went to the evidentiary hearing, Walmart provided a witness that had very little firsthand knowledge of the events at issue and based most of her testimony on secondhand reports, records that she had read from the employer. At the hearing, the applicant for unemployment benefits requested that these two managers be subpoenaed on the basis that they had more firsthand knowledge of the events at dispute, and the ULJ denied the subpoenas. Once this dispute came to this court, the Court of Appeals did hold that the denial of such subpoenas was an abuse of discretion, and based its holding in part on the fact that such witnesses would have had relevant firsthand information as to the events at dispute. If the court has no further questions.
Anything else from the panel? All right, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you very much, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent Respondent, Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED for short. And you can refer to me as Ms. Phillips or counsel. So here the ULJ determined that relator did not quit because of a good reason caused by the employer because, among other reasons, the employer offered the relator reasonable accommodations in the form of different face shields, different masks, as well as additional breaks. The ULJ further determined that the exception for quitting due to medical necessity did not apply because it was not medically necessary to quit at the time that she did quit, and because of those reasonable accommodations that the employer was providing. The ULJ's decision is legally correct and supported by the evidence in the record. So with regard to the good reason caused by the employer, first, there was no breach of promise or change in the terms of her employment here. We have her testimony that she was, working the afternoon shift and pulling her mask down when nobody was around. She testified that she told her supervisor, I can't work with the mask on for my entire shift. This does not create an agreement or void the policy. So the relator was aware of the employer's policy, and she knew that the employer could enforce it at any time, and that's why she didn't want to work the morning shift. So the employer's enforcement of a reasonable, known policy didn't breach any kind of agreement or change the terms of her employment. And in addition, like the ULJ found, the relator was never promised that she would only have to work the afternoon shift. The employer's witness testified that it was a condition of her employment that she may have to work other shifts, and the relator didn't dispute this. She said she was never promised that she would only have to work the afternoon shift. Second, the evidence.
So, neither side has the burden of proof. And no one disputes the woman had emphysema, okay, which, sounds bad to me. And no one disputes, it appears that, they gave her the breaks, they gave her the different face masks, which didn't seem to work. But if no one has the burden of proof and she is pro se, what was the harm of not getting the doctor in to conclusively establish, lots of people have emphysema, hers is mild, the mask isn't a deal breaker, or, I said she didn't really need, she didn't really not have to wear a mask, but if I had known, that the breaks and the face mask, maybe it would have been different. What's the harm in not having that fleshed out once and for all, since we know for sure she's got emphysema?
Yes. I think the ULJ is weighing, getting this hearing done efficiently and getting all the information that's necessary.
I'm all in favor of.
Yes, and that testimony is just not necessary for the ULJ to make the determination for either of the exceptions here. The relator did testify that her doctor told her, I'm not going to write you a note. I don't believe that wearing a mask interferes with your employment. She didn't provide any information.
And this was her doctor that she saw. The record indicates this was her doctor that she sees on a regular basis.
That's right. She said he knew about my condition. So she didn't, in requesting a subpoena, she didn't identify any additional information that he would have that would change that testimony. He hadn't changed his mind. And even if we had that testimony that, yes, it's difficult to wear a mask while working when you have emphysema, which is plausible, the employer here was working with her to find an accommodation. And so these two exceptions don't apply in large part because the employer was providing these accommodations and trying to work with her. And she did quit before she really explored those different options. So the employer was acknowledging that this may be difficult for you to do. Let us try some different things here. The notes from that September 9th meeting show that the HR representative and the supervisor met with the relator, and the HR rep said, why don't you try some different face coverings, and said something like, if there's anything that you would like to request from us, let us know. There's testimony that she tried at least one face shield and it wouldn't stay on. Her testimony was then, I think the ULJ asked, well, did you talk to anybody about that? And she said, well, no, I just decided to keep working and pull my mask down when necessary. So I think her testimony...
Which the record indicates they already told her, don't do that.
Yes, she knew that that was a policy violation at that time. And so...
Does the record indicate... she's a cleaning person working at the hospital. Does the record indicate, she's on floors where there are patients? So it's not like... Because, it's the morning and the afternoon shift, so presumably there are patients in the hospital. So she's not like, people are in the hospital at night too, but like, I don't know, I guess people are in the hospital all the time. So, never mind. I've answered my own question.
Yeah. There you go. Yes, there is evidence that there were COVID patients in the hospital, and the record shows that she was cleaning offices as well as hospital spaces. So the record shows that she didn't explore that, trying to wear a face shield or trying to wear a combination of a face shield and a mask or, trying a different face shield. She testified on her last day, they brought me a lighter weight face shield, but I'd already quit at that point. So the record shows that, before she had the opportunity to try these accommodations, she decided to quit when she was moved.
Was that legally relevant? That she'd already turned in her... does that do anything to diminish, if we were questioning whether she had good cause to quit? Would we say, aha, they offered her the lighter face shield. She no longer had good cause to quit.
I think it just tends to show that there were other options available that she didn't pursue. She could have asked for a lighter face shield before she put that notice in. It's not clear if she knew there was a lighter weight face shield in that building. I'm not sure about that. Her testimony was it wasn't staying on. I did mention that to my supervisor, and I decided just to continue working and pull my mask down. And that was in, I believe... That was, before she gave her notice of quitting. So I think it just tends to show that there were other face shields out there. She didn't testify about trying to adjust it or trying to make it work. And the evidence just doesn't show that, or the evidence shows that it was a reasonable accommodation, that the employer was providing reasonable accommodations for her, and that she kind of quit before trying those out. The other... accommodation, the employer said, well, you can take additional breaks. And her response is, well, how can I take additional breaks when I can't get my work done? But there's no evidence that the employer was forcing her to work through breaks, requiring her to work through breaks, requiring her to work longer. There's nothing to suggest that the employer, was saying, no, really, you can take additional breaks and we'll work with you on that. So she quit before she tried that out. So any testimony that they wouldn't let her take those breaks is premature, speculative. She didn't actually try that. She didn't try to take those additional breaks. And so because the employer offered her these accommodations, it wasn't a good reason caused by the employer for quitting. And also it doesn't meet the exception to ineligibility for quitting due to medical necessity, because that's also a requirement. And under the quit medical requirement, I would just note that, you know, the hospital wasn't required to provide the specific accommodation she requested. Under the exception, it's just required to provide reasonable accommodations. And again, these accommodations were reasonable. With regard to the subpoena request, I think I already addressed that. Yeah, the unemployment law judge did not abuse her discretion by declining to subpoena the doctor. The ULJ did not abuse her discretion by not subpoenaing the supervisor. The subpoena request for the supervisor was a little unclear. There was a written document submitted before the hearing saying the ULJ may need to subpoena the supervisor. You know, the ULJ determined, at least, you know, implicitly, that she did not need to subpoena the supervisor. Even looking at Relator's testimony about her conversations with the supervisor, you know, that even taking everything she said to be true and accurate, that wouldn't change anything. She may have been talking to her supervisor about her health condition, and it may be that her supervisor was aware that perhaps she pulled her mask down and maybe didn't enforce that policy. I'm not sure. We don't know that for sure, but that wouldn't change the outcome here because the employer had a very clear policy. She knew about the policy. There's testimony from Ms. Lesman that she had multiple conversations with the relator about needing to comply with the policy. She said there were multiple conversations with her supervisor present, and the relator did not deny that she knew that that was the expectation and that she would be expected to comply with it if she moved to the morning shift. So there was not an abuse of discretion by not subpoenaing those two witnesses.
Counsel for the relator argued, though, that having the immediate supervisor there may have corroborated, may have helped with credibility findings. Would that have mattered in this case?
I don't believe it would have mattered. You know, some of the conflicting testimony that may be material to this case is, did she have permission to not wear her mask when she worked the afternoon shift? You know, the employer's witness said, no, she did not have permission to work without her mask. The relator's testimony was, oh, I told my supervisor, and he knew, you know, that people were aware that I would do this. So even if we, you know, got the supervisor and took his testimony, and even if he admitted, yeah, I knew it, and I didn't always enforce the policy, you know, that would not change the outcome. It would not create any kind of agreement that she could continue to violate the policy. It doesn't void the policy. It wouldn't have made a difference, even if the supervisor would have testified that all of these things were true, because the evidence shows that there was a clear policy. She knew what it was. She knew that the employer may enforce it, and that's, you know, what the employer did when she started that morning shift. They immediately said, you need to pull your mask up. So it wouldn't have made any difference to have subpoenaed the supervisor. It wouldn't have provided any testimony that was new or different or would change the analysis. Okay. Well, I believe I've made the points that I wanted to make today. If there's no additional questions from the panel, I would just conclude that the ULJ correctly determined that the relator does not meet any of the exceptions to ineligibility for quitting, and indeed respectfully request that the court affirm the ULJ's decision.
Thank you. Anything else from the panel? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just to address a few points that counsel for, or that respondent made, I apologize. First of all, the issue of reasonable accommodations and respondent's assertion that because Cook provided reasonable accommodations, we don't really even need to get to how availing or how persuasive Dr. Ellaby's testimony was. There is no no evidence in the record supporting an assertion that the face shield accommodation was a sufficient accommodation for Ms. Clemmer. Ms. Clemmer testified that as she worked, as she did the physical work necessary of a housekeeper, the face mask would fall off. Respondent admits that she told this to her manager. Conversely, Ms. Leisman had absolutely no idea whether Ms. Clemmer even used the face mask at all. That's something Ms. Leisman testifies to in the record. To the issue of the breaks that Ms. Clemmer was told she could take, Ms. Clemmer testifies that with her condition, she worked slower than most housekeepers as a baseline. So it took her longer to get her work done than everybody else that worked at Cook or than most other people that worked at Cook. She testifies in documents submitted to the ULJ before the hearing was held that sometimes it took her 10 to 12 hours to finish all of the assignments that she had been given for a shift. So yes, while she may not have specifically addressed the issue with Cook Hospital, it was an illusory accommodation. When she was asked, you know, did you ever address this with Cook, she said, no, but I had to do what needed to be done. There was no testimony that was developed any further from this, but that goes back to the whole point that we need to have an additional fact-finding hearing to flesh out some of these issues. Ms. Clemmer was pro se when the initial evidentiary hearing was conducted, and there were very likely some facts in the record that were not appropriately developed by the ULJ while this initial hearing was going on.
Like what?
Again, like any sort of conversations that may have happened between her and Mr. Tillotson, any additional information about how often she used accommodations, what sort of accommodations she tried, any other conversations that happened in regard to the accommodations. I think a testimony from Cook as to whether she would have been expected to work more had she taken additional breaks would have been particularly helpful. If Ms. Clemmer would have had to work an additional 15 minutes for every break she took, that's certainly relevant as to whether it was reasonable accommodation. I will also point out that Ms. Clemmer testified in her evidentiary hearing that one of the accommodations she did request from Cook was to stay on that afternoon shift, and she testified that that was one of the accommodations that Cook had provided to her. As to the lighter weight face shield, this is sort of a nitpicky point, but Ms. Clemmer didn't quit before she had the chance to use the face shield. She put in her notice of resignation for a date, 10 days further, and Cook gave her the face shield to use after she put in her notice of resignation. So conceivably, she would have had about 10 days to use this lighter weight face shield, but Cook accepted her resignation before she had a chance to use it. So Cook came to her and said, you can just be done today, before she had a chance to use that accommodation. So for those reasons, we do need to get to the validity of Dr. Allaby's opinion. We do need to have an additional fact-finding hearing to drill into what the basis of this opinion was. And I will also very quickly point out that while it is true that Ms. Clemmer may not have been as clear as she probably could have been in her initial request to subpoena Michael Tillotson in particular. Respondent is correct that she said something to the effect of, you may need to subpoena Michael Tillotson. I will point out, especially for pro se parties, it is the duty of the ULJ to interpret the claims of pro se parties. So at the very least, the ULJ should have brought up the issue of maybe needing to subpoena Michael Tillotson in the hearing itself and allowed Ms. Clemmer an opportunity to expound on the idea that he may need to be a party that's subpoenaed. And I think that is all of the points that I would like to make, so unless the panel has any further questions.
Anything else from the panel this morning? All right, thank you very much, counsel. The matter is now submitted. Thank you for your submissions. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period.